Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
Welcome to Vegas World. Time to party, and I'm your most excellent host, JC Vega. Thank you all for tuning in. We got a lot to cover this week. Some exciting news coming out of New York City Comic Con, as well as my review of The Penguin Episode 5, as well as Episode 2 of the Netflix series Queen of Villains. Let's not waste any time, shall we? Let's dive right into it. Let's talk about the most exciting news for me coming out of New York City Comic Con, and it pertains to Daredevil Born Again. We have a release date now, finally, for the show. It's supposed to come out of the spring of 2024, but due to the WGA and SAG strikes, the show was on a indefinite delay because they didn't know how long those were going to last. But luckily, they finished and wrapped up all the troubles they had over last summer, and we're back on March 25th, 2025. I'm so stoked. Another big question about the show is whether or not it was going to be a reboot or a continuation of the Netflix series. And that was something that I had on my mind too, because when Daredevil showed up in She-Hulk, he was kind of a little more jovial and lighthearted. And I was like, okay, that's not really necessarily how he was in the Netflix series. So that kind of was made me hesitant. But, you know, Vincent D'Onofrio was in Hawkeye, and he was pretty much the kingpin he was in the series. And a quote from Vincent D'Onofrio at New York City Comic Con, this is coming from Collider, was as followed: "We're continuing the darkness of the first series on Netflix. It's going to be that dark and that intense. We worked our butts off to make it that way, so we're excited about it because of that. As far as I'm concerned, the biggest question that I get asked the most is it going to be dark like the original series? And the answer to that is a definite yes. It is dark. It is crazy. We do some things that are definitely a first for a Disney Plus." And that quote right there makes me even more excited, because I loved that Netflix series, man. It was pretty gritty, fairly grounded in its approach. And even that show, they teased that they were part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but like, they weren't really, because like Kevin Feige and like any other projects going on at that time never acknowledged them. They referenced the Avengers movie, but like, that's about it. It was pretty much its own thing. But that's really awesome that they're going to continue on, so to speak. I've seen another quote said where it's going to be them. It's going to have all the characters' previous histories, but they're just at a different point in their lives now. So that's cool. They say also too that they're not necessarily going to be following any storyline in particular too closely. I know it's called Born Again, but you know, it's going to be its own little thing, and that's cool. Thank God for that, because like, again, I don't like it when things are one-to-one translated. It doesn't necessarily work out too well. Like, you know, Watchmen, for example, Zack Snyder got the visuals right, but the tone, yeah, he missed the mark a lot on that one. But no, this is really good news. I'm excited about it. Can't wait. I can't wait for a trailer to come out. And once that comes out, we're going to definitely talk about that one. DC Comics announced that they are bringing back the Vertigo imprint. Vertigo started in 1993 and was shuttered in 2020 by then President Pamela Lifford, who was not a big fan of imprints. The Sandman universe survived that, and it was moved over to the DC Black Label, as well as John Constantine and Hellblazer. But they are going back over to Vertigo. The first book in the relaunch is going to be The Nice House by the Sea. It was created by James Tinian IV. It was a creator-owned series, and Vertigo had that unique hybrid of creator-owned books, such as Preacher, Why the Last Man, Metropolitan, or Transmetropolitan, excuse me. And as well as, you know, revamps, like I said, The Sandman, which Neil Gaiman revamped, but I thought that was an original creation of his, because he gave such a unique and fresh spin on the character. Swamp Thing, Alan Moore, you know, was a critical success. That was really unique. You know, John Constantine, Hellblazer, Lucifer, decides to vacate the throne of hell and, you know, open a bar in Los Angeles. That was really cool. And, like, you know, we need more variety in our comic books. While superhero stories are great, there's plenty of different genres and ways to tell a story, and Vertigo was definitely known for that. So that is really cool. The Running Man is getting a reboot, remake, or readaption, if you will. It was a Stephen King novel and an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie back in the late 80s. And this movie is going to be directed by Edgar Wright, who directed Baby Driver and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Last Night in Soho. And they said that this movie will be more in line with the book, which is a bleak dystopian book. So we're not going to see the colorful characters that we did fighting Arnold Schwarzenegger, and you're not going to see Ben Richards spouting out one-liners and what have you, as Arnold was known to do at the height of his powers. The character from the book was also a lot more of a thinker and resourceful. And you're just not going to get that with Arnold Schwarzenegger, because why would you? Look at the man. He was jacked. Even when he wasn't Mr. Universe anymore, the man was super swole. And you ain't going to have him not be an action hero. So, on one hand, I'm excited to see this movie, because if you've seen Edgar Wright's work, you know how his style is very unique. It catches the eye. He's got a lot of humor. And I'm sure he'll have some dark humor in this movie. But at the same time, I'm really tired of reboots, remakes. I'd like to see something original come out. That'd be nice. But nonetheless, that's how Hollywood makes its money. And they feel that they're only be able to make money, whether it's a superhero movie or some known IP that they can make money off of. Glenn Powell is going to be the Ben Richards character in this version as well. Michael Cera has also joined the cast. Michael Cera worked with Edgar Wright on Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Amelia Jones from Lock and Key is also going to be in this movie. None of their roles are known yet. I do know that the Richard Dawson character, Damon Killian, will not have an appearance in this movie, because Damon Killian was a movie creation. And this, they don't really have a certain or a singular villain in the book. It was more just the ominous games network that didn't have a face. So that'll be interesting to see how they play around with that aspect of the story. I do know that they're probably going to change the ending. They didn't use that ending from the book in the original movie. I don't think they will in this one, because Ben Richards flies a plane into the game network's headquarters. And I don't think they're going to want to have a 9/11-like visual to end the movie. As cathartic as that might have been in the book, times are way different. I mean, they weren't necessarily all that different in 87 when the movie came out, the original movie. But, you know, you had Richard Dawson there to get beat up by Arnold Schwarzenegger and to give the audience some vindication and some gratification that he gets his in the end. But, you know, it's Edgar Wright. He's very good at what he does. And I'm certain he will make it his own. It'll probably be more experimental. I don't want to say art house-like, but, you know, it's going to be, I'm sure he'll have Edgar Wright's signature style. I'm just curious to see how he does that and not use the colorful characters that were in the original movie. The new Star Wars movie entitled New Jedi Order that's going to star Daisy Ridley as Rey Skywalker, I forgot her name for a second, has lost its screenwriter. Steven Knight has dropped out of the project. The project was previously written by Damon Lindelof, Justin Britt Gibson, who wrote for Banshee and the Strain. Lindelof wrote Lost and Watchmen, respectively. And they're looking for a new writer. It's being directed by Sharman Obeid Chinoy, who has directed A Girl in the River. And, you know, I hope that this project serves as a make good to the fans and to Daisy Ridley herself, because let's face it, that new trilogy was garbage. I mean, it started off promising, even though it did feel like A New Hope. And, you know, J.J. Abrams played it safe. Rian Johnson went completely the opposite way and pissed off all the Star Wars fans, or at least the hardcore ones. When I first saw it, I liked the movie, you know, as it was. But when I looked at the bigger picture and the overall series, it started to make less and less sense and was really annoying because we didn't get to see Luke, Han, and Leia together again, all on screen. And hell, even J.J. Abrams wasted Luke Skywalker. He was on a freaking island and showed up for the last, like, minute and a half of the movie or whatever it was. So hopefully this movie can, again, right the ship. Because Star Wars, much like Marvel, has been in a state of flux. There have been some good projects. The Mandalorian started out really promising and then kind of, I guess, fell off a cliff in the latest season. Book of Boba Fett, which I was looking forward to because, as I know from extended lore from Star Wars, he is a badass bounty hunter, and he really wasn't in this show a badass bounty hunter. Obi-Wan Kenobi, that series was a mixed bag for me. Well, I did enjoy the fight between him and Darth Vader. Yeah, the overall story was just, it left a lot to be desired, especially because they used Leia, while the actress, the little girl actress, was phenomenal. She was well-trained and played Leia sassy and to the T. It kind of ruins the lore a little bit, because in A New Hope, she says, oh, you know, helped my father in the rebellion. And, like, wouldn't she remember that Obi-Wan saved her? I get, you know, we can't get everything right as far as lore goes, and maybe somebody forgot, but I feel with the brain trust over at Skywalker Studios, or whatever it's called, Lucasfilms, Jesus Christ, can't get the name right, Lucasfilm would have had some continuity guy, because apparently they have a bunch of those on staff, to be like, well, actually, you know, she never met Obi-Wan, because in her message to him, she acted like she didn't know him. But, you know, we're gonna see. Maybe also John Boyega might pop back up. There's been talks about that. And if anybody needs a make good and a hey, we're sorry, it's John Boyega. Because that dude got the short end of the stick in the series. Like, again, in The Force Awakens, he was a pretty big part of the story. And, you know, he was a stormtrooper who, turned and joined the rebellion. So that was interesting. You could have done so much with that, and they didn't do anything with it. They had him flee the next movie, even though he chose to, you know, fight with the rebellion in the first movie and wanted to be a part of that. And they teased him with a lightsaber, and everyone thought he'd turn out to be a Jedi. But I guess, possibly, maybe Disney was like, maybe we shouldn't have a black man wield a lightsaber, even though we had Samuel Jackson. Yep. He had a purple lightsaber? Yep. He's one of the strongest ones? Yep. Anyway, nonetheless, they dropped a writer. They're going to get another one. Hopefully, they do something good with that. Hopefully. I'm not going to hold my breath because The Acolyte has been trash. Book of Boba Fett was trash. Ahsoka, I don't even remember it, and I watched it. That's how good that was, man. Like, and I hate saying that because I was looking forward to that too, because, you know, Rosario Dawson is a tremendous actress. General Thrawn is a badass character. And, you know, they just, they left a lot to be desired. And the brain trust over at Lucasfilms needs to figure out something. And speaking of the whole Disney conglomerate, Blade has been pulled from the 2025 release schedule for Marvel Studios. This movie has practically been in development hell for the last 5 years. Mahershala Ali was announced to play Blade at the 2019 Comic-Con Hall H panel. He was among all those people who were, like, when they announced that Thor Love and Thunder was coming out, The Eternals, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, Black Widow, he was a part of that panel. He had a cameo. Well, he had a voiceover cameo in The Eternals teasing that he was a part of this. And since then, we've had nothing. They've gone through 6 writers and 2 directors in the last 5 years. They were supposed to start filming in May of 2023, and they had to shut down production due to the writer's strike because they were supposed to start filming later that month in Atlanta, and they pushed back to June, and the writer's strike kept going, and they tapped Michael Green, who wrote Logan and Blade Runner 2049, to write the whole thing from scratch at that point. They've gone through, I would think that was like the 4th writer at that point. That is ridiculous. What can y'all not figure out with this story, man? It shouldn't be that hard. A guy who's half man, half vampire, who hunts other vampires. There's a whole plethora of things you could play with there. I know you probably don't want to do the same thing that the Wesley Snipes franchise did, and you shouldn't in a sense, but like, what are you missing? What do y'all not like? Why are we having so many problems with this? I feel like it's cursed, and maybe that line from Deadpool and Wolverine, Wesley Snipes Blade said there's only going to be one Blade. That was probably prophetic, because it seems like we're not getting it. Hell, for all I know, at the time of this release of this episode, Mahershala Ali may drop out altogether, and you might not see him in a Marvel movie. I don't know. But it's inexplicable that they've had so many problems with this production, and that they can't seem to figure out a clear vision for what they want to do with Blade. And I don't know, maybe it's a situation like Edgar Wright and Joss Whedon had before. And a lot of directors have said that Marvel is pretty hands-on, and they have certain things that you need to fit into the movie to set up something else in the future. Maybe that's a part of it. I don't know. Maybe maybe Mahershala Ali wants a more character-focused story, which, I mean, I guess any actor would necessarily, but I don't know. It's almost going the way of the Crow reboot. I mean, over the past 10 to 15 years, there were like so many different directors attached to it, so many different actors. Bradley Cooper, Luke Evans, Jason Momoa were all at some point attached to play Eric Draven. It's gonna be, I guess this might be the same way. We might talk about this movie for years to come, and maybe there's gonna be a plethora of more actors who are signed on to play Blade, and we never get the movie until, I guess, 20 years from now, when it's not wanted or desired, and people are gonna hate that one, much like this Crow reboot. I don't know. Maybe. Possibly. All I know is that it's frustrating, it's annoying. I'm sure it's annoying for Mahershala Ali, because he signed to a contract. He can't do much else unless he does these projects. And I think, I mean, if it gets on the slate at some point and they're shooting like next year at some point, he's gonna have to do it. Unless he, like, I guess gets out of his contract somehow, and so he can do other things. He's 50 years old. Wesley Snipes is 62, and he seemed pretty athletic still for a guy his age, because he pulled off some sweet martial arts stuff in the Deadpool and Wolverine movie. And maybe Mahershala Ali can do the same. You know, age is nothing but a number, it is what you make it, and maybe he's pretty limber and still in tremendous shape. I don't know, but maybe he doesn't want to be, you know, 63 and trotting out for his first solo movie as Blade, if he even sticks around that long. Like, I feel like the story writes itself in a sense. Half man, half vampire hunts other vampires. There's a lot of inner turmoil. Like, this shouldn't be that hard. What are we missing? What are we not getting? I can't even speak, guys. That's how frustrated and flabbergasted I am at this. And it's even crazier seeing the timeline of this whole thing when I look at comicbook.com. They had the whole timeline, everything for all the way back to 2013 when Kevin Feige announced that Blade would be part of Marvel Studios. It's that insane. It is what it is. Yep, that's all I'll leave it on. It is what it is. Hopefully, maybe they'll surprise us. Maybe in the end of 2026, we get a Blade movie. Maybe they film it in secret in 2025. I have no earthly idea. I just want them to do it. And I just want it to be good. That's what I want. Marvel needs that. Marvel needs a string of hits. Marvel needs to prove they can still put out bangers, as the kids say. Again, I feel like I cringe when I say that. But they need to show that was not just the lightning in the bottle, that they can recreate that magic. And this last two phases has been nothing but a mess. It seems like they're flying out of the seat of their pants and they had nothing else thought of after the Infinity Saga. And I hope at some point I can look back and be proven wrong, or at least that they show that, hey, we still got it. The Penguin, Episode 5, Homecoming. Man, just when I thought that, I mean, this show is so good, man. I keep saying it, it's so good, and it just keeps getting better and better. You know, the police are out looking for Johnny Vitti, the cousin of Sophia Falcone. They want to know what happened. What happened to what's going on with the family? And she ain't giving much. She don't know what's going on. The Penguin's making moves to try to take advantage of the situation that Sophia presented to him. We get a little bit more a look at Oswald's mother, who's suffering from dementia, and she confuses Vic for being Oswald, and then she snaps out of it. I mean, I've never had a relative or anybody I know deal with dementia, but I hear that early on stage dementia can be like that, where like they, you know, space out for a minute and think that it's a different time, or the person they're talking to is somebody else. It's like that. So that was really sad to see, in a sense, and how, you know, Vic is dealing with that and entrusted to take care of Oswald's mother, because the Maronis are probably gonna make a move after what happened in Episode 4. Like, the story, man, the story's progressing and it's heating up, and they pulled a twist on me that I thought, you know, I thought we were gonna see one family completely wiped out, and that's not the case. And the Penguin probably made a grave mistake in crossing both the Maronis and the Falcones at some point. It seems like it's setting up that he's gonna, you know, it's gonna bite him in the ass, and he's gonna have his work cut out for him. You know, he tried to get the product back, the shrooms that they introduced a couple episodes ago that Sophia Falcone was working on. You know, that Oswald thought that would be the new ticket for the drug trade in Gotham City. This is more than just a comic book show, man. This is prestige crime drama. It is so well written and well produced. The cinematography, I keep saying it, man, it's so good. I don't think there's anything negative I can really say about this show. Or this episode, rather, either. Maybe I guess the one critique I think of is we haven't really spent a whole lot of time with Oswald since maybe the first couple episodes. I guess if I wanted to, like, critique or find something to be upset about with this. But no, man, this has been so good. And it's just getting better and better. And I'm on the edge of my seat waiting for that Episode 6 to come out so I can watch it, because if I had to put it up there as far as TV shows go, as far as crime shows that I like, it's up there with Breaking Bad. It is, for me. It's up there with that, like, Yellowstone. I guess Yellowstone, oh, it's more of a cop show, but, like, in that world, I like, you know, Breaking Bad, The Penguin, Longmire, and Justified. Justified's a great show. You should watch that too. Back to episode 5, Homecoming. Man, the scene with the Penguin and Sal Maroni's wife, you know, to trade off for their son for the drugs. Ooh boy, that went away that I was not ready for. And man, that Penguin's a cold-blooded dude. I mean, we saw it in the beginning of the series when he killed Alberto, and that, you know, spiraled the whole family and showed an opportunity for him to take more power since Carmine's dead. But man, what he does to Sal's wife. Ooh, boy. Wow, that was wild. I don't want to spoil it. Again, like, I'm trying to talk about it without giving away too much because I want y'all to watch it and I want y'all to enjoy it. I'm still trying to figure out how this non-spoiler reviews should go, I'll be honest with you. Because this is one show that I can't spoil. I don't want to spoil for you. I'm curious to see what role Dr. Julian Rush plays, because he seems like he's siding with Sophia Falcone. This kind of feels almost like a Joker-Harley Quinn relationship, because Harley Quinn was a psychiatrist at Arkham Asylum, and she fell in love with Joker. This kind of feels like that, in a sense. Maybe I'm reaching a little bit with that comparison. I don't know. But Julian Rush seems almost like a lovesick puppy for Sophia. I get that he feels guilty for all the crap she endured at Arkham when her father put her in there. But maybe his loyalty is going to come to be tested. He might not make it. Maybe because of by her hand or by somebody else, perhaps. I'm not sure. For all I know, that she could get double-crossed by somebody else. And Julian, you know, sleeps with the fishes because of that. Could go any way. All I know is that I am ready for episode 6, Gold Summit. And the log line for this episode, it says, and this is from IMDb, despite his enemies' attempts to smoke him out, Oz seeks to expand his reach in the city. Meanwhile, Victor crosses paths with a former adversary. I mean, there was a guy we saw a close-up of that seemed very interested in Vic and Oswald's mom. Maybe this guy disrupts one of Vic's tasks that Oswald gives to him, or maybe he does something to Oswald personally that gets him upset and Vic's got to make it right. I don't know. I can't wait to find out, though, what happens in episode 6. But before we get into my Queen of Villains review, let's talk a little bit about the Power Rangers. Normally, I would have Aaron Nova and Kaden Green talking to Power Rangers with me, and we are going to have a review of Dino Fury and Cosmic Fury in a couple of weeks once I finish my binging, and I'm sure they finish all their binging, and we can figure out a day to get together to discuss it. But Hasbro has put up props and suits up for auction. Hasbro partnered with Heritage Auctions, and, you know, they've put a lot of stuff dating back all the way to 1993 up for sale. Hunter Dino, who played Amelia Jones in Cosmic Fury, expressed her unhappiness with the fact that they were being sold instead of given to the actors or stunt people. I can see her side of it because, you know, I mean, she's the one who spent time in the suit. She worked really hard on that show. It's, you know, for a lot of people on the show, it's their big break and maybe one of the only jobs in acting they'll get, because not a whole lot of Power Ranger actors go on to successful projects or steady work in the field of acting because of the stigma of Power Rangers, for better or worse. But yeah, that kind of sucks that, you know, instead of giving it to you, they put it up for auction that could go for thousands and thousands of dollars. And of course, there are fans out there who had a petition to other fans not to buy any of the suits or props so that the actors, whoever wanted it, could get it And of course, you know that didn't fly probably with a good portion of the internet because it's the internet. And they are gonna, you know, cause a ruckus and probably bid on something just to bid on it, just to jack up the price. Or even if they get it, they'll try to maybe sell it to the actor for an even bigger price or something stupid like that. I don't know, but it sucks. And it just speaks a lot to what Hasbro wants to do with Power Rangers, I guess. Because there hasn't been an announcement of a new show. The reboot from Netflix has been scrapped, I guess. Or they're going to shop it to another streaming service or network, what have you, to possibly do something with it. But it's clear as day that Hasbro does not have a definitive plan yet in place for this series, or franchise rather, and that maybe we're not going to get anything new. Maybe it is an end of an era, possibly. I know fans of Transformers and G.I. Joe have talked about their displeasure of Hasbro and how they handle that sort of stuff and how they might be relatively cheap when it comes to producing stuff. But time will tell. But yeah, for Hunter Dino, I am sorry that you're having to deal with this. I'm sorry that you might have to bid on your suit to get it, or that you may not even get it, and that the studio just couldn't, you know, be nice and give it to you. That sucks. And I saw your displeasure on Twitter, and, you know, my heart goes out to you on that. But again, like I said, I see all sides of the argument. The Queen of Villains, Episode 2. We get a little bit more time with the young wrestling prospects who are having to clean and vacuum and do all this stuff for the veteran wrestlers, like clean their gear, get beat up by them, have to deal with bullying or hazing, as it's called. We also see a bit of a double cross in this episode too, some old school carny stuff, which, I mean, double crossing has happened a lot in wrestling. More back in the territory days in the 40s and the more carnival days of professional wrestling. I mean, the last screw job, I guess, would be 97, if you want to be technical, because that was when Bret Hart got screwed out of the WWF title. When he was put in the sharpshooter by Shawn Michaels and the bell was rung on him because he was going to WCW. But in this episode, you know, the All Japan Women's Wrestling is struggling to find a new star. They're losing their primetime TV deal and they're getting put on late night and they need to come up with something because Jackie ain't cutting it anymore as a big star and they need to create another star. And they think that maybe one of these young prospects are going to be the one to do it. And in the match Jackie has with Chigusa, she gets double-crossed. She's supposed to win the match in the very last second. But one of the owners tells the young girl that she's going to go over. She needs to go over and needs to make it happen because that'll ignite business. And it gets a good reaction from the crowd. The other owners are not happy with it because that wasn't what they planned. And to the dude's credit, he was like, look, how are we going to make stars if we don't put effort into it and making these stars? She's got to win in order to make it. That's cool. That was cool to see that aspect of pro wrestling and that old school and how they dealt with things and that nature when the business was more closed off and kayfabed. That was really cool. And it was cool to see the relationship between Lioness Asuka and Chigusa Nagoyo, as because they were supposed to wrestle each other. Nagayo talks about quitting because she doesn't feel she's very good at wrestling. She's good at martial arts. And Lioness Asuka is also good at martial arts, and they promise each other that they are going to have, you know, almost a martial arts battle and wrestle that way. And that kind of style, you know, was prominent in the late 80s, even in the 90s. Antonio Inoki tried to have more shoot-style fights in New Japan, but to the detriment of the product, I guess. So that was neat kind of see that. I don't know if necessarily that was how martial arts got infused into pro wrestling. Maybe. But no, the girls start their match. The referee, who's one of the owners, or another trainer, gets pissed off that they're doing karate stuff and tells them no martial arts, but the crowd gets engaged to it. They go in an all-out bloody battle, going back and forth. The crowd's into it. And the owner, who double-crossed the other owners earlier, sees potential in this. And in this moment, Don't Masumoto gets inspired that she wants to get in the ring. Early in the episode, she gets tasked with driving the promoter around because he doesn't have a license and they're needing to promote the show. And she's got a license, so they're hanging out. And she asks, what's it take to be a star or somebody important in wrestling? And he says, the wrestling itself doesn't necessarily matter. It's how you get people in the building. It's drawing money. Money is important. Being a star, that's what's going to get people. That's what's going to make you important in professional wrestling. That's what you need. You can't teach being a star. You just got to have it and have that it factor that will get the people invested in you. And how she sees her two friends going out in the ring and getting that bloody battle, inspiring the fans to get invested in their match, and inspires her. And the episode ends off with her asking to be a wrestler. So it seems like we're getting close to her debuting, because first episode she was having a rough go and trying to learn it. And I know the real life Dump Matsumoto takes a long time for her to get in the swing of things and to become a wrestler. So yeah, it's getting there. We're gonna see how she becomes a star, and I can't wait for that, because I've seen some of her matches, and to see it depicted in fiction, it's gonna be really cool. It was also kind of neat and sad to see Jackie, because, you know, she tells the young girls that she wasn't very dedicated to pro wrestling and that it should have been her retiring instead of Maki, because either she didn't have her heart in it or she broke one of the three taboos, which is a big no-no. Which I don't know why you would fire Maki then instead of Jackie, but then again, Jackie was a star, and like, if they're not working together, you gotta keep the one that is presumably more valuable to the product, if that's how the promoter's hands were tied, and Maki was fed up with it. But, and, you know, she leaves at the end of this episode, towards the end of this episode, and quits. You know, she has that match where she gets double crossed, and that's the end of her. So that was kind of sad and, you know, neat to see, because the beautiful pair was a pretty big integral part of women's wrestling in the AJPW in the late 80s, mid 80s. So that was neat to see her send off. I wonder if we'll see her again in a future episode, possibly. Again, I don't know. I don't know too much about their story per se to know their full career. But yeah, I like the aspects of, again, showing the old school way of training. And sometimes it seems like the matches, they try to portray them like they're real, as in like there's no cooperation, but in the moment, like, you know, where Jackie gets double crossed, it shows that, well, there's a plan. And I get maybe, like, it might not be that appealing to a general audience to see that in depth of how the wrestling is done and how that's everything's put together. You know, maybe also, even though kayfabe is dead for the most part, I know in Japan it's treated more like a sport. Maybe, you know, maybe the people in charge over there in Japan, maybe they were tight-lipped on how the sausage is made, so to speak. So, you know, they had to take some creative license in order to make the show. You know, I've seen it done in Fighting With My Family, how they made it seem like everything was a shoot, a reel, as I should say. I need to stop using wrestling terms. Made it seem everything was real and that nothing was pre-planned and that there wasn't a big overarching plan for this character and all that stuff. So, some of the wrestling, you know, there's some decent wrestling in this episode. It's mostly, like I said, mostly strikes and kicks. You don't really get super big body slams or anything like that. I know I read an article where they said the girls worked pretty hard to learn the wrestling moves, and it wasn't necessarily the best wrestling I've seen, but again, this is more of a drama than an actual wrestling show. But yeah, I'm liking it a lot. Lioness Asuka, real name Tomoko, her parents, who left her when she was young with her aunt, they disappeared, show up to the show. And that this is before her big match with Chigusa. And she gets very upset at seeing them, and she wishes they would have stayed gone. That was kind of heartbreaking because, you know, the dad's on his knees apologizing profusely and how he didn't want to leave her, but they couldn't afford to take care of her. And she's just says, you know what, you should have stayed gone. And she just runs off. That's sad. That's sad too. It's sad also that she thought about giving up wrestling. And I hope, I'm assuming, obviously, because it seems like she had a long career, that she's going to stick around on the show and in the dojo. That's another thing too about dojo life. You know, they show the girls cleaning up the veteran wrestlers' gear and stuff, making them food. That's a legit thing in Japanese wrestling. That's been around, I guess, that's been around since the early days of Japanese wrestling, where you're either a prospect or a relatively newcomer lives in a dojo, almost like a dorm style. They're all there, and they got to do everything for the veterans, like clean their clothes, just get their food ready, do whatever task is needed of them for the wrestler, what they need to do. That's a tough lifestyle, I hear, and it was kind of neat getting a little bit of that in this show. I like that. Again, I said before, I don't know too much about female wrestling, but I know a little bit about how Japanese wrestling works overall. If I had to give the episode a rating, I give it a 3.5 out of 5. The Penguin episode, I'll give a 4 out of 5. I'm still trying to work out the format of how I want to do reviews. I know we're going to do more spoiler review, like scene-by-scene breakdowns. I like that format a lot. I'm still trying to figure out my voice as far as how to give spoiler-free reviews. I'm not a critic. I'm just a movie film buff who has an opinion. And I'm still trying, again, this is still trying to figure out how I want to format it and how I should do these reviews. And a matter of fact, I'm going to open up for questions or maybe even feedback. You know, questions or feedback. We have an email address, vegasworldpodcast@gmail.com. You can drop a line there. You can ask questions, or you could, you know, give your feedback on how you would like to hear these reviews, on what it is you'd like. Maybe it's for me to review. I don't know, maybe I'll open it up to that part, you know, because this is Vegas World and I do what I want. But I'm also curious to see how necessarily, you know, you all would like to hear and what style of review. So you can drop a line there, follow me, Vegas World Pod, on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow me personally, my wrestling profiles at TheJCVega. You can also go to ProWrestlingTees.com to buy your own JC Vegas merch. There's a Vegas World t-shirt on there that you can get your hands on. Look cool. It's the coolest wrestling merchandise around, bar none. So thank you all for listening, and I'll see you next week.